You're listening to a DM podcast.
Hi, I'm Nigel Marsh, and this is the Five of My Life podcast, the show where five choices reveal sideways insights into the lives, opinions, and lessons of interesting people. Tom Nash is a quadruple amputee, giving him a unique view on life and how to make the best of it. His experience serves sharply to put one's own problems in their proper perspective. A gifted storyteller, this conversation stayed with me, reminding me to focus on what's important and to attempt to set aside the irrelevant noise. So, Tom, welcome to Five of My Life.
Am I on it now?
You're on it now, mate. What we do, we roll straight in.
Is this being filmed?
No.
Oh, okay.
Would you like it to be?
No, not necessarily. But I'm sitting here wiping my head with a tissue because it's so hot. And I just thought I'm going to look like a right twat.
Talking about filmed, I was sent by our mutual mate a pilot of your cooking show.
Mm.
It's bloody brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
No,
appreciate
I mean,
it.
Really? Yeah. So what stage are we at? Do you mind explaining what it is and then telling me what stage we're at?
It's a TV show called Last Meal, whereby I interview a series of people that centers around what their last meal would be if the world were to be ending tomorrow.
Cheery?
Yeah, that's right. I've always found it to be an interesting question. I ask a lot of people what their last meal would be because it forces them to kind of think about almost their whole life and their experiences and their family members and memories that they had and all this sort of stuff. And you know, the more people think about that question, the better their answers get. And you know that expression, like you see your life flash before your eyes? It's almost like you're forcing their life to flash before their eyes when you ask them that question. So as the story goes, I would ask everybody that question when I would interview them. And I asked this one particular guy who I became friends with subsequently. And he's a very successful kind of artist manager and filmmaker and producer. And then he approached me to come to his birthday, his 40th birthday years later. And I made him his last meal for his 40th birthday.
Right.
And it happened to be quite a difficult meal to make. It was this Sri Lankan dessert called Vatalapan, which is this, it's almost like a steamed cake, or I guess like a rice pudding, if you can imagine that. I'd never heard of it, obviously. And so in order to try and work out how to make this thing, I ended up on YouTube till all hours of the morning watching these Sri Lankan grandmothers making it with the closed captions on and everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And to boot, I had to make a lactose-free version because he's lactose intolerant. And so I presented this thing at his birthday, much to the amazement of the predominantly Sri Lankan and Indian crowd that were there, and they really liked it. So I think he turned around to me and he said, "We've got to make a TV show out of this. Like, how can we incorporate that into an interview?"
Yes.
And so it would be something along the lines of, this week my guest is Nigel and his last meal would be chicken pot pie, and so you and I would actually cook it together.
Right.
And then it gives us the platform to frame particular questions and conversations around the end of life theme. So it might be something like, you know, what legacy do you feel you've left behind? Do you have any regrets in your life? If it was your last day, you know, what would you say to your family? Or, you know, there's so many questions that you could ask around when you're faced with death, I guess.
Yeah.
It forces you to look at your life differently. And I think it just makes for an interesting conversation, and certainly the kind of conversation that you wouldn't normally have with the kinds of guests we'd have on. So it's not going to be sort of like, you know, let's say you'd have, I'll give a crude example, but let's say it's Keanu Reeves. You're not going to get the kind of interview that he's going to do on Kimmel when you start talking about end of life type stuff.
So I'm very conflicted because that is exactly what I'm trying to do with this show.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So how dare you get off my lawn, because you are brilliant TV talent. I don't know if you know that.
Oh, thank you. No, I don't know that. But I thought I had a better face for radio. At least I've been told.
No, and so I think there's, so it's the American networks you want to pick it up.
I don't know. I mean, I would be happy with it going anywhere where it had a very wide audience.
I think it's brilliant, and I think that it's only like 4 minutes long, the thing I've seen, but I immediately get the concept and I immediately like the concept. And you are a compelling and distinctive front man.
That's what my mother's always told me.
So it's not the usual suspects. So good on you.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the point of me being the host is, apart from it being something that I used to ask people a lot, is that I am someone that's come close to death and has been forced to have those conversations and think about my life in that way. And I think that gives me a bit of a unique insight into that aspect of it. And sometimes when I talk to people about those types of things, it can be disarming not to employ too great of a pun. But yeah.
well, so here we go. There will be people listening to this who have no idea why disarming is a pun.
Because I have no arms. Yeah.
I'm sure we're going to come on to that in there. We should start with your first choice, actually.
This is why you should have introed it. Don't let me start talking because then we're just going to confuse everyone.
No one will understand. So we always start with the film on Five My Life, and you've chosen the wonderful Midnight in Paris, Woody Allen's film. Tell us why you've chosen that.
There are several reasons why I chose Midnight in Paris. I'm a huge Woody Allen fan, and I can even watch his bad movies and still quite enjoy them. But also, Paris is my favorite city in the world. I think the opening sequence of that movie catches the city in a particular light that I'm always reminded of. And it sort of sets me up in a way that I'm at peace watching it. I also just really like, I love those 1920s years, and I love all the artists from that time, you know, whether it be Salvador Dali or Ernest Hemingway or whoever it is. A lot of them are sort of my literary or artistic heroes, and so it dipping into the that era of time is kind of a perfect intersection between my favorite city and my favorite artist. And it's funny on top of that. And so, yeah, so it's always just been the perfect combination for me. I can watch it as many times. I can watch it right after having watched it, which is a mark of a good movie, I guess.
His sort of homages to New York with those beautiful pictures of the Brooklyn Bridge and blah. He did a New York on Paris.
In Manhattan, you mean?
Yeah. He did the same thing, I agree, for the city. It looks beautiful.
And then the following year for To Run With Love, which was, I guess, a similar homage, albeit different story. But it also had that, playing with time idea.
Yes.
Dipping back through loops. I kind of like in Midnight in Paris how, it's not often talked about how they dip back into the second loop of ending up at La Belle Époque.
Yeah.
Where, he's talking to, I forget what the character's name is, Marion Cotillard plays the artist groupie or whoever it is, who keeps insisting that La Belle Époque is the best time, know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then they get looped back there and then they meet a bunch of people who are having the same conversation. And it's sort of, because I struggle with that as well a lot of the time, thinking sometimes I would like to have been born in a different era. And it's ridiculous because, the first thing you have to think of is, going to the dentist and antibiotics. And I think those two things would count me out of any decade but the one I'm currently in.
So, but what one can do retrospectively, it's completely selective, where you take the very, very best bits that you happen to like. So it's like the Impressionists. You go, wouldn't it be brilliant? But you go, no, they were all, half of them committed suicide. They had syphilis. It was a disaster. You're picking a version
of course, I would be
smoking with Van Gogh before he's cut his ear off and he'd be teaching me to paint. And you go, yeah, but mate, that's not really.
That's right. Well, if you lived during that time, you were probably just a peasant and died straight at 29 or something like that.
That's right.
So
it was Allen's 41st film.
I didn't know that.
Holy crap.
He just bangs one out every year.
It's just incredible. Yeah. But it makes me want to ask you, how are you on the old workaholic thing? So Woody cracks it out, one a year, every year for 100 years.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't be able to do something like that, I don't think. I mean, I'm working all the time only because I choose to do what I really love doing.
And what is that? Tell us. What do you work at?
I mean, so I'm a speaker now. But I write, I speak, I research, I make content, I learn. That's actually the thing that I do the most, is that I learn. There's all sorts of subsidiary tasks that I have within that, administrative stuff that I dislike, obviously, that everyone does. Any sort of creative field that you're in, I find, even when I was DJing as well, Is 90% of it is not doing the thing that you want to be doing. You know, it's all of the administrative stuff in between.
And that's exactly
the
right.
The promotion, the emails, and the fucking MailChimp. It's just no, yeah.
And that stuff is disproportionately important.
Oh yeah,
sadly.
Of course, yeah. It's like a weird Pareto distribution of you. Like that's the 80% of your work.
And you've published a book recently.
Yes, I published a book this year. It's a memoir. It's called Hook, Line, and Sinner, right. And I started writing it, I think, around 2019. I'd been writing bits and pieces over the course of my life that, you know, were to contribute to a book in the future. But being a memoir, you know, I certainly couldn't write it earlier than this. I'm 41 now.
Yep.
And I did get approached just after I got out of hospital to write a book by a couple of publishers. And I was like, about what?
Yeah.
They were like, well, you know, you've just been through this horrible thing. And I'm like, yeah, that's not good enough for a book. Like, I have to have been through this horrible thing and then achieved something to have something to write about, right?
But were they even slightly embarrassed about ambulance chasing?
No, they don't give a fuck. I mean, not at all.
Hey, great news. Yeah, you've had an awful thing happen to you.
Let's do
a book.
Yeah, here's my business card. The book idea was just very much something that I wanted to do around this point in my life. And around 2019, I started thinking like, okay, I think I've got enough for something here.
Yep.
But it wasn't enough for something complete. And that's why I sort of named it a semiography rather than an autobiography.
Nice. Yeah.
Because I would like to be afforded the opportunity to continue the conversation later in life at some point, perhaps in another work. So it's sort of my life up until this point, but I needed to wait to be able to crystallize a lot of ideas that I thought could be of use to readers.
Yes.
So it wasn't just a story of what happened to me, but it was also something that people could draw from for themselves.
Yes.
Basically I just waited until I reached that point and started writing, hoping to just bash something out that was worth reading.
So it's interesting that the semiography I've fallen into a routine of writing a decade books, which I find quite liberating. So I did Fat 40 and Fired and Fit 50 and Fired Up and Smart, Stupid and 60.
Right.
And the fact that I do them in a decade helps me go, so this is not in tablets of stone.
Mm.
This is the stuff that I believe at the age of 40, and this is my journey, if anyone gives a shit, at 40.
Mm.
But I reserve the right to have changed my mind on everything.
Yeah, of course.
When I write my 50.
And
I'll write one when I'm 70, and I might say, do you know what? I'm really embarrassed by all the things I wrote in my 60 book. And you go, but I'm not apologizing for it. You go, that's what I thought at the time.
But I'd be surprised if you didn't change your opinion on, like, if you hadn't changed your opinion on things, you're probably not doing it right.
One of the things about your work that I mean, there's lots of it I admire, lots of reasons I admire it, but I enormously admire your heroic resistance to do the obvious. So there's sort of, and I'm sure the bloke I'm about to mention.
Can I use that as the like?
Yes. Put it on the front cover.
I think you've said that better than anyone.
Yes. Heroic. Whatever I said, I've forgotten what I've said, but it was good when I said it. So there's a guy.
Resistance to do the obvious.
Well, there's a guy.
I'm not sure how heroic it is.
It is. And there's something, I'm going to mention someone, and I'm sure he is brilliant, but the 127 hours bloke who sawed his leg off because he was caught under a boulder and blah, blah, blah. There's sort of, it's a bit like doing poverty porn or hardship porn or crisis porn or oh my God, woe is me porn. And you go, and I feel a bit purient. You go, I love the fact, let's not just do the thing that the publisher who came to you when you were getting out of your hospital bed, let's not do that book and that story.
Yeah.
I mean, please?
Yeah, it's not pragmatic. And if it's not useful to everyone else, that would mean that I'm in a way being dishonest, if only to myself, but probably to others. And you know what they say about people, like, I mean, if you don't lie, you never have to remember anything. So just think of it as me being lazy.
Right. Yeah. Well, so that's a good link to your book. God, I loved it.
The laziness.
well, you chose Nassim Taleb's Anti-Fragile.
Yes.
Ah, God. So another one of my guests, Emile Sherman, the Oscar-winning producer, chose Fooled by Randomness.
Oh, yeah.
And obviously Black Swan, fabulous. So I've now read all his bloody books. This was sensational. Would you mind just briefly describing the core thesis in it and then telling us why you chose it?
Yes. So Anti-Fragile is a book that was written by Nassim Taleb, who is actually an economist and an options trader. So recently I kind of learned how many parallels there are between economics and life philosophy. it's not something that you would think, but it really works. And anti-fragile was a word that didn't exist until he wrote the book, and it is the opposite of fragile, right? And so the best example between fragile and anti-fragile, and then obviously you have resilience that lies in the middle. A wine glass is fragile, a rock is resilient, but your muscular system is anti-fragile. And the difference is you put stresses on a wine glass, it breaks. You put stresses on a rock, nothing happens. You put stresses on your muscular system, i.e. lift weights, you get stronger. So it's just that which operates in the opposite way to what fragile things do. And you might think, okay, so what? Well, he describes it in a kind of academic way, a lot about complex systems most of the time. And you'll forgive me, it's been years since I've actually read it. But, he talks about your immune system being anti-fragile, such that you can give it a little bit of a virus and it develops antibodies, right? So it benefits from disorder and stresses. And he also goes on to describe other complex systems that I find even more interesting, which are anti-fragile, things like the airline industry, right? Which you don't necessarily think of planes as being anti-fragile, but the industry as a whole is. And the reason is after every crash, each crash gets safer increasingly because there are all sorts of safety audit systems that happen and regulations that develop subsequent to a crash. And so I guess the trick is to try and live as an anti-fragile person. And I stumbled across this book years ago after having read about something called post-traumatic growth. I think I read a paper or an article by Tedeschi and Cal Horn, who are some psychology researchers in the US. And post-traumatic growth is the inverse of post-traumatic stress. You don't hear about it often, I suspect, because there's really not much money to be made of it. It's not a disorder, so no one's getting paid to tell you it exists.
Yeah.
But it's an actual thing where people post having gone through adversity or trauma actually develop a growth mindset after it. Now, this was something that I'd actually developed like of my own volition. I didn't intend to, but I just happened to. But I'd never seen it put into words before until years ago when I started reading about post-traumatic growth. I found it quite interesting, so I was researching that a lot. And I stumbled upon Anti-Fragile, the book. And then I read that and I thought, oh, this is everything that I've experienced and that's happening to me. And it also sort of chronicles the way that I approach life and look at the world. So things like the way that I manage expectations using framing techniques to turn negatives into positive, basically living your life in a way that there's more upside than downside. That's to be anti-fragile. And I don't think it's a skill that you develop over time. I don't think it's a binary thing. It's not that you are or aren't anti-fragile. The way that I experience this is you go through ebbs and flows, but over time you become more anti-fragile than not, because all of the skills that you develop to respond to things in an anti-fragile way develop exponentially. It's like compound interest. You get so good at them that you just have this almost like automatic response to negative events where you see silver linings or you see opportunity or you know how to grow from something rather than regarding it as a setback. You don't go into things expecting the best thing to happen. So when something small that's good happens, you see it as a win. And it works conversely as well. So like you expect the worst to happen all the time. I use this trick, and I was telling someone about it the other day. Anytime I stay in a hotel or an Airbnb, or indeed when I go to a restaurant or something like that, I always read the worst reviews that I can find. So I sort of expect
right.
it okay. to be a shit experience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, I'm never disappointed, right? It either matches my expectations or exceeds them.
Yeah.
So I'm never going to have a bad night if I set it up like that. And then another technique that I use that I found many years ago, a guy called Tim Ferriss developed a thing called fear setting. I started using it it would have been a long time ago now, 7 or 8 years or something. And I do it all the time still to this day, which is it's the opposite to goal setting. So, well, it's not the opposite, but You know, goal setting would be writing out a bunch of goals and how you would achieve them. Fear setting is writing out a list of everything that you fear that might happen, and then in another column next to it, writing out how you might mitigate that or prevent it from occurring. And then another column, which is called repair, which is what do you do even if you've tried to prevent it and it still happens. Now, it's much more useful just as a mental exercise than anything else, because you wouldn't believe how much you let go of your fears once they've actually been written out and you've thought about how you would mitigate or repair what had happened. It's literally just a mental exercise. I do it all the time because I found out that, you know, most of your fears are like these programs that run in the background. Like if you think about your brain as an operating system, there's always background tasks that are happening. And I think your fears operate within that subconscious, what would you call it, like fabric that you're not always thinking about, but they cause some sort of stress in the background. And once you sort of iron out the creases of knowing exactly what you would do if those things come to fruition, it really puts your mind at ease. So, you know, between mentally preparing yourself and emotionally preparing yourself for, you know, negative events and managing expectations and then learning how to reframe when bad things happen, I think these are all things that lead you to be anti-fragile. There's other things like diversification is another good one that I found. Like being good at more than one thing is a really good skill. Because you think about like the pandemic, right? Anybody who was only good at doing one thing and that thing happened to get shut down during the pandemic was fucked, right? But if you had two things that you were good at, yeah, you could pivot, right? Also, being good at two things, if those two things happen to be complementary, actually help you to niche out better than anything else. Like you're a great speaker and you're a great researcher, let's say. So a podcast is a great niche for you because you can research people really well and you can talk to people well. If you only did one of those things, you would only have one job and you would be one of many. And so to rise to the top, it would be much more difficult.
Right.
But the intersection between two or more skills is more unique than you're never going to be the best at just one thing. You know?
Yeah. Fascinating, going back to you talking about fear setting, something that I use in my life from a course I went on ages ago, you know, 40 years ago as a young advertising executive, a negotiation course. And the bloke talked about BATNA, the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. And it's changed my life, right?
So forget, tell me about it.
Forget negotiated agreement, but just the best alternative to anything. So if you want something, right, you go, well, obviously you can focus on the thing that you want and why you want it and how wonderful it would be if you get it. That's standard default. You haven't got to do much work on that, right? But just pretend, you know, I want a huge guest. You know, I want to get, you know, Paul McCartney on, whatever else, and wouldn't that be great, right? Work on the best alternative to getting that and make yourself write a big list of all the wonderful reasons why it's great, why you get the other person, not him. I mean, just right, pretend. Okay. I mean, this is very disrespectful to Ringo Starr.
I was going to say Ringo.
Because I would love Ringo Starr. But just pretend.
Some people are a bit, you know, they're like, what'd you say about Ringo?
So just pretend. I mean, which is not the case. Yeah. I'm not judging the Beatles. But just pretend I my number one was Paul and my number two was Ringo.
Yeah.
You go, put lots of mental energy internally behind why it would be sensational to get Ringo. And then if Paul, you know, too busy on his tour, he's not going to come on Five My Life, and I got Ringo, then I'm like your hotel example, I'm delighted to get Ringo because I've already worked out. It's not a lame second choice. So it could be trying to rent a flat. You go, you don't get it, a unit, and you go, well, that's great, actually, because, you know, I can stay in the place where I currently am and I really like it because, you know, but so it's a, I mean, it's a trick and it's not Pollyanna-ish. It's not suggesting that it's all brilliant. But if I didn't get X, you know, what are all the advantages of the second option?
Does it have to be the second, or could you aim? What if you aimed for like the fifth?
Yeah. The best alternative to getting what you want, I suppose. It needn't be the second.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I'm going to try that.
Well, so the thing on the book that you chose on Five My Life, which thank you, because it made me read his third one, which I hadn't read, I think it's mind-changingly brilliant purely because of the difference between robust and anti-fragile. You can spend a lifetime going, I'm not going to let this break me, I'm not going to let this. So being the rock and really well intentioned, you go, I'm going to stay in this rubbish marriage or stay in this rubbish job or da 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 da, and I'm going to be that stiff upper lip. It's not going to break me.
Mm.
As a goal to aim for, just a new concept, just as a word, it's helpful. How can I use this to make the most of my life rather than how can I endure? Now, that's endurance is good, but you go.
It's also boring, isn't it?
Yeah.
It encourages stagnation. I think it's just – it's one of those things that's gotten away from us a bit as a society to the point where, you know, resilience is just this buzzword now that nobody really thinks of what it is they're saying.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like coming out of COVID. Like, do you want to be resilient? Resilient from COVID would have meant that we didn't really learn anything or become better to protect ourselves against the next pandemic, which is definitely coming at some point, right? That's not what we should be aiming for, right? We should be aiming for that dress rehearsal to have fortified us from any future threats. Then we would be anti-fragile.
And so I think robustness, so I would disagree with Taleb. I mean, God, he's got the brain the size of an African country. So who am I? I am but a weakling in his presence. But I would humbly disagree with him. I think you don't move from fragile to robust to anti-fragile.
I think
robustness is a subset of anti-fragile. You have to be robust not to crumble, else you won't be around to be anti-fragile.
I think it's been a few years since I read this, but from memory, I thought his position was you can't be anti-fragile without first being fragile.
Yeah.
Is that right?
You've got to incorporate with many things in life, all of them, but you need to end up as anti-fragile.
Yeah, that's right. But it's sort of becoming anti-fragile is a sort of process by which a fragile thing morphs into being anti-fragile.
Yeah.
But once something is robust, it can't get to anti-fragile.
Because it's fixed.
Yeah. Because because it's fixed.
Now, for my listeners who don't know your story, would you mind? I don't want to recap it in an inaccurate way. Would you mind?
Just recapping
why we're talking about fragile and anti-fragile, and why the arms gag worked for some people but not for others.
Yeah, I am a quadruple amputee,
right?
And I contracted meningococcal when I was 19. And I was in hospital for about 18 months. I lost both legs below the knee, both arms at the elbow. And since then, made the brave decision not to become a Paralympian, but to become a nightclub DJ instead. And so for about 15, 17 years of my life, my career has been in nightclubs, DJing. I run an events company with my closest friend, and we've played, you know, music festivals and DJed all over the world. And
do you still do that? Clubs?
Yeah, I do, yeah. I don't DJ as much these days just because I'm 41 now and there's a limited amount of conversations I can have with 20-year-olds on balconies of nightclubs. But I still enjoy it. Actually, I think I enjoy it now more than I ever did because my relationship with it now is non-monetary, really. You know,
yes.
I'm not doing it as a career anymore. I do it mainly for fun. And that's always a better way to treat anything that you love, particularly artistically. I think people get caught up in too much of that follow your passion crap and just, do it until you have to get paid for it and it will kill your passion quicker than anything.
That's right.
I like what we were talking about before. There's like administrative things that sort of creep in that just make it, just not a fun experience. So I really like DJing now. I mean, Chris and I will get a gig every now and then. We'll get together a couple of weeks before and put a set together and it's fun and we go down and play, and that's it. We don't need to take gigs we don't want to do.
Sure.
So you're never in that position. And we still run a couple of parties every year. We just pick the ones that we enjoyed the most, which is like our Halloween party and our Mardi Gras party that we do every year. They're ones that we can decorate really well for and just make a really cool experience for people. So yeah, that's my experience with it now. And as a main gig now, I'm doing basically public speaking.
Right.
Conference, like keynotes and things like that, writing books, articles, doing podcasts.
More power to you, matey. So the third choice on Five My Life is the song. And so much as I have to thank you for the anti-fragile choice, because I adored that, we have to part company on your song choice. And I'm not supposed to be judgmental.
Oh, you can be judgmental.
The trouble is, the joy, the snot has been beaten out of your choice because I've heard it 50 billion times.
Right, of course.
So it is brilliant, but it's Hotel California by the Eagles. Welcome to the Hotel California.
The reason I chose it, I mean, music for me is one, like, I mean, I hated this the most out of all of the five because, I mean, I'm in music and there's no way you can pick a song. So I just had to pick one that had a significance for me in terms of my memory. And
that's the format. Yeah. Thank you. It's not your favorite. It's one that enables you to springboard into the story.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it... it's because it, for some reason, reminds me of Dallas. That's where I grew up.
You are?
Yeah.
God, what do I know? You were born in Texas?
No, I was actually born in South Africa.
Holy crap. Yeah. Okay, right.
But I lived there for only 2 years, so I don't remember South Africa. And then I went to America, and I was only there for about 7 years. So my memories of it are pretty scant, but it's one of the songs. There's a few songs that remind me of growing up in Texas, and that's one of them. And the reason I actually chose that over the other ones that remind me of that time is that when I started to learn to play guitar when I was about 15 or however old I was, that was one of the songs that I taught myself.
Right.
Hotel California, complete with all of the guitar solos and everything like that. And I say that because I was an avid guitarist before I lost my arms. And it was one of those things that, I mean, it's bad enough losing your arms, right? You sort of think to yourself, it's such a loss of independence. And it's also beset by so much, not understanding of how things could work. You know, when you're 19 years old, you lose your arms, you're like, I don't think I've ever seen anyone with prosthetic arms. Is that a thing? Like, what do people do? You just don't know what's going on. So I'm just clouded at that time with, like, not only have I, I'm faced with losing my arms, the loss of independence and, the ambiguity that lies ahead of me, but also I'm not going to play the guitar again, which was the one thing that I knew I really loved. Because, when you're 19, you don't know shit, right?
Mm.
All I knew was that I loved playing music. I didn't know what I wanted to do as a job yet. I hadn't formed an identity, but I knew I loved playing music. And then that was going to be gone forever. But I did get prosthetic arms and I got hooks and I carved out my own path. And I actually designed something to play the guitar again.
Wow. How? Excuse my, I'm looking at you now and I'm impressed and puzzled. Yeah. So how on earth?
You're right with that Hotel California now?
Hotel bloody California. So did you learn Smoke on the Water first and then Hotel California? Stairway to Heaven.
I mean, Smoke on the Water would have been early because it's such an easy song to play.
That's right.
I ran through a bunch of designs.
Right.
In my head, because I was determined to find a way to play the guitar again. And I've got these two prosthetic hooks, which were sort of designed during the First World War. They're really old design. They've even got, see this little hole, for those of you listening, there's a little hole in the hook that looks like it might be for a pen. It's actually designed for cigarettes because they were designed for diggers that lost their arms in the trenches and stuff. So I was trying to work out a way that these hooks could... Like I'd have an adaptation of some sort that I could play guitar with. And I went through all of these iterations of different designs that were increasingly stupid ideas. And there were things that would like be a stamp that would go over the fretboard where I'd press a button and it would do like an A or a C or whatever it was. And then that was too complicated. And then, through a few different iterations, I realized that if I could get something that formed a bar chord, then that could sort of transpose itself up the fretboard. But then I realized that the frets are increasingly small as you go up, so it's not going to – that won't scale, sorry to use the pun. And then I just realized that, I don't need to form the bar chord. I just need to tune the strings in a certain way that if you hit all of one fret, that plays
like a slide guitar styling.
And that's what I designed.
Yeah, nice.
So I designed a slide that would fit into my hook and a pick holder that would fit into my right hook. I got an engineer to make it. I converted my own Stratocaster. I put flat wound strings. I raised the action and I just played it on my lap and I could just play open chords. You know, the thing wasn't the engineering part. The engineering part wasn't that interesting. What was interesting was what I was doing was redefining the problem.
Right.
Right. So before I might have been forgiven for thinking, oh, well, I have to be able to play intricately on a guitar. Right.
Yes.
The goal isn't to be Jimmy Page. You know, if I'm being honest, the goal was never to be Jimmy Page. The things that I enjoyed about playing guitar were writing songs, playing with my friends, and, you know, a collaborative, you know, sense of enjoyment around music. I could do those without being an intricately good guitar player. I just need to be able to play chords.
I imagine you talk about this in your speeches. That's so profound, where to genuinely understand the thing that you are getting from something, where I do a park run where you go for a run every Saturday morning with people. It's a free thing that happens in parks around the world, right? But just pretend something happened to me like happened to you. You go, but why am I really doing that event on a Saturday morning? Now, in its current form, I tootle along outside in a park.
Mm. Yeah?
But I could run on a treadmill in a gym.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. So maybe it's
a collaborative thing.
That's right. Mm. It's a ritual. So that's a really great question. When you go, it comes back to your anti-fragile thing. You go, and also the Batner. You go, if life wasn't going to be unwelcomingly interrupted, I'd carry on playing the guitar and doing the solo with individual notes.
Yep.
But fuck it has.
Mm.
I can't change the fact that it has.
Yeah.
So what did I actually like?
And yes.
I love that. It's a really powerful tool.
Yeah, it's just quite often problem solving is about redefining the problem.
Yeah.
You know? I learned it as well. I remember I, again, was telling someone this the other day where I, when I first was living independently, so got out of hospital and that's when I really started to get good at using my hooks because I was just left alone.
Right.
Because when I was with other people, you know, it would be easy for them to just do things for me.
Sure.
And so when I was on my own, I was like, okay, now I have to start working out. I'm like, how do I light my cigarettes?
Yes.
For a while, I had support workers leaving like a candle, but then that would blow out. And so, you know, and I couldn't use those Bic lighters. I tried for so long because they've got those metal coil things. And I'm just holding it, click, 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 click. It's not working. You know, there's people who tell you, if at first you don't succeed, try again.
No,
absolute
up.
Bullshit. Well, no, you just don't give up. Just think of a different way to do it, right? And so I went through all these different ideas of like using the toaster and then putting it under a piece of paper under the grill and running out of the backyard and stamping it out. And this one time I was doing that and I just walked past this box of barbecue matches and I'm like, oh, I can do that. That's the different way to achieve the same result. And I sat there all day just striking matches and just getting really good at doing that. And then I was fine. As long as I had matches on me, I was golden, right? And it was that point that I realized I wasn't trying to use a lighter. I was trying to set fire to something.
That's it. I love it.
We face those problems all the time where we fall prey to this sort of path dependence because a problem has always been solved this way or it's something that's always been done one way. And if there's one gift that's been bestowed upon me, it's the lesson that not everything has to be done the same way.
Yeah.
And I think that is one of the things that makes me anti-fragile as well, is that I very naturally problem solve completely differently to most people.
So I'm going to ask you a completely left field question.
Cool.
What is the most hilarious disaster? So that you are full of wonderful stories about how
you mean like world disaster?
No. You are very, very inspirational. I know you fight against that, but you are. But I want to know the most embarrassing, ridiculous disaster from you learning how to use your hooks or your prosthetics, where you know someone went to shake your hand and then jumped away. Or tell me a humorous disaster story if you can.
I could tell you a story about I was in Paris. This is about 7 or 8 years ago, and I was walking down Montmartre in Rue des Abbesses, quite a steep, not that steep, but for me with no ankles, like a reasonably steep road. And there was this woman holding this Mexican hairless dog. Have you seen these dogs?
No.
They look ridiculous, yeah. Right? Is it Mexican hair? I think it might be Chinese crested, sorry. Whichever one, they're sort of all, they're bald and they've got this little tuft of hair on their head. Right. They just look ridiculous. And I love dogs, but this thing is just absurd. And I'm walking down the street and this old woman's just holding it and it's looking at me like, and I just started laughing at it and pointing at it when I was doing that. And as I did, my right leg snapped in half.
Nice.
Yeah. So karma just exacted its revenge in the moment it decided to. And I just went tumbling to the ground. And it's a bit of a problem, right? Because, you know, you're not in the country where you have all the services like I have here. If it happened to be here, I can go, you know, to my guy in Alexandria and fix it up. Over there, my French is conversational, but I can't talk to a prosthetist about breaking, you know, something really complicated. So I had to get in an Uber. So if you can imagine, my right leg has snapped off where the ankle is.
Yeah.
They're now two different lengths. So I can't really walk properly at all anyway. And it's just a titanium rod.
Yeah.
So it's a complete nightmare. I'm not a wheelchair guy, right? I wouldn't even know where to get a wheelchair. So I'm just like hopping all over the place and just walking on this pole. I look like a pirate with polio or something like that. I don't know. Yeah.
But this is a good disaster story.
Is that all right? Is that what you're looking for?
well, the reason, because I'm squeezing my buttocks in embarrassment when I'm remembering the story, but I've got a dear friend who is wheelchair bound and was hit by a fire engine and so he can't feed himself. Mm. And it's not my natural thing. So when I have dinner with him, I will feed him. Mm. About, you know, I don't know, 10 years in, he said, "Nigel, I'm not a fucking baby." And you go, what do you guess? Well, because adult humans who don't have to deal with people with disabilities and have to feed them, their only default knowledge of feeding other people is I've got four kids feeding babies.
Oh, okay, I see.
So you give them inky pinky portions.
Right.
Right, so you go, I've been sitting here for a decade as you've been putting a tiny little bit of pasta in my back, could you? Load up the fork, you twat, and feed me properly.
I thought you was going to say something like, you can stop the here comes the aeroplane thing.
Oh, God. And then so I imagine that there are really loving, well-intentioned people who are awkward in your presence. And do you find yourself having to put them at ease, or do you get irritated by it, or have I diagnosed
that
wrong?
No, I don't. Oh, and I mean, everyone irritates me, but not for that reason. there are some people, I guess, that don't know how to take me on face value or whatever. I've become pretty good at quashing that quite quickly. It might be making a joke, or I've had quite a few people tell me that after having spoken to me for an hour, they forget I don't have hands.
We're going to move to your place. And I've got, mate, the pressure's on because my daughter is in Paris.
Oh, really?
Right. For 2 weeks, very unusual. And I sent her the link that you sent me. Mm-hmm. So it better be good because she's going today.
Yeah.
So your place.
Is she going there today?
Yeah.
So, oh, I'll tell the owner. She's going in.
Le Carafon, which is a cafe in Paris.
That's right.
Tell us why you have chosen that.
Normally I would have chosen Paris the city. Since I picked Midnight in Paris as the movie, I thought I ought to be more specific.
Thank you.
And Le Carafon is a very much a locals bar in Montmartre. It's just on the outside of the hill, I guess, on the sort of western side. I started going there maybe 4 years ago. I was taken there by a guy that I met in a bar randomly that year. I was having dinner with my wife at the time, and he was with a friend. And I was telling her about, I think I was talking about recipes and food, and I was talking about bourguignon, actually. And I was like, telling her how I think I'm going to improve my bourguignon. And this guy just leans over and he said, he starts telling me about how I should put chocolate in it right at the end. And I was like, I've never heard that on any recipe. Like, who is this guy? And he's quite interesting. He was around my age, maybe a couple of years older. He had a very thick French accent, but you could tell he was quite a gregarious character. He seemed to know a lot of people around that would pass. He was sort of man of about town. And we just got talking that night and we hit it off. And he was like, oh, I'll give you all these recommendations of places to eat, because he was an avid cook as well and a fan of a lot of restaurants around the area. And it turned out that I knew a lot of places he was recommending, so I kind of knew that he knew what he was doing. And he was like, oh, do you want to come to this bar? It's like, this is where all my friends go. And, you know, they have good food, it's cheap. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds good. And the first time I went there, I met maybe like 20 people that I still am friends with now. They all just converged.
They were complete strangers at the time.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they would just welcome with open arms kind of thing. They're all really interesting people, all walks of life. You have everyone from their 20s to their 60s going to this place. People sometimes even bring their kids there and they sit there eating little saucisson while their parents drink wine and play guitar and all this. It's, it was crazy sort of community vibe. And yeah, so ever since then, and I go to Paris once, at least once a year, probably twice. And now I always just stay around there, and a lot of my friends associated with that place. And it just so happens to be the setting of the last chapter of my book, because I had this interaction with Damien there. Damien is the guy that I was talking about that I met, who I've subsequently become really good friends with. And that last chapter revolves around a conversation that we had, that I remember us having, where he kind of enlightened me to something that I think I struggle with in the book, which is this dichotomy between what I want to be to people and what they expect of me.
Right.
And it sort of is a bit of a tip of the hat to what you were saying before about, oh, hey, you know, the hooks aren't the most interesting thing about you. And I appreciate that. Thank you very much. But I often get this sense that they are from people. And I think that makes me work extra hard for it not to be about that. I'm very good at sneaking vegetables into food, right? I do it with my dog. I do it with my girlfriend, because neither of them like vegetables. Yeah. And I do it in conversation as well. So I notice that a lot of people are interested in what happened to me and the hooks and all that sort of stuff. But what I really think they need is the vegetables, you know, yeah, which is the important messages that come from what I've been through.
So this is fascinating, mate, because if I go back to your TV show, right, in the world of popular entertainment, for you to lean in and own the fact that there will be Hollywood executives who go, a cooking show with a bloke with no arms? Great! That might be what gets you the fucking, excuse my language, gets you the audition.
Maybe,
and gets you.
Might right? be, yeah.
And you go, and that's fine.
It's fine,
and then
yeah,
what you want is, 10 minutes into the first episode, you go, my God, that interview with that other person is fascinating. That dish, that recipe is fascinating. So I think you sneak the vegetables in really, really well. You go, well, actually, in some, this is going to sound so crass, so please forgive me.
No, I like crass. That's good.
It's sort of an advantage in certain situations.
It is. Yeah, no, it's a massive advantage. That's not crass at all. That's how I think of my life.
The back to the heroic resistance. You don't make the whole bloody show about how can I cook with no arms.
That's
you go,
right.
No.
Yeah, that would be boring.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful. Mate, your possession on
yes.
Five My Life is your grandfather's shoes. Could
yep.
you describe them and yep. tell us why you've chosen them?
Well, they're nothing that a description would benefit from. They're black dress shoes. The way that I thought about answering this when you posed this question to me was, if my house was burning down, what would I grab?
And it would be these.
It would be these.
Right.
Because they're one of the only things that I own that are irreplaceable. Just because of what they are, I guess. You know, all my photos have been digitized. I'm backed up on the cloud. You know what I mean? Hmm. But my grandfather's shoes, I think, like the only thing that I got when he died. And he was a very important person to me. He's an interesting guy. He's from Teesside. He was a teenager during the Second World War, was a part of the Home Guard anti-aircraft brigade. And didn't come from a very well-off family, quite debilitatingly working class, for lack of a better description, and was the youngest of, I think, seven kids. And I think his father died young, and he took care of some siblings of his, some sisters. and you know, worked and paved his way through like a technical college, became an electrical engineer, and then seized this opportunity to move to Bahrain to work for a company called Bapco. And he would have been the most successful out of the whole family, and that's kind of not saying much, you know, even though it was a reasonable role. But he just worked his way up, and he even had to go over there for a year without his wife and just be alone. And he was living in this place called Awali. It's, you know, 45, 50 degrees. They're working in these oil refineries where it's probably 60 degrees. They have no air conditioning. They're living in huts. He was somebody that managed to take himself from one particular situation and through his own grit and determination, I guess, was able to, you know, put his kids through a good school and completely change his position in life. And he lived in Bahrain for 30 years. Both my father and auntie were born there. As such, my father became quite a nomadic individual. And that's why I was actually born in South Africa and then grew up in the States, because my dad was traveling for work and stuff.
Did you ever tell your granddad how important he was to you?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So you were close. You had a relationship whereby.
Yeah, we were. Yeah, and even though he lived in the UK, and I would go over and visit every couple of year or 2 years or something like that. A funny story about that: he came out. Both of my grandparents came out, and my auntie and uncle, when I was on life support in hospital, presumably because they'd been told that I wasn't going to make it because I had like a 10% chance of survival. And I remember having a conversation with him. You know, he had that look in his eye where he was kind of like, he didn't think I was going to make it. He was just sort of saying goodbye.
Mm.
And I remember saying to him, "And when I get out of here, I'll come and visit you." And he was just like, "Yeah, sure." You know, didn't believe me at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, all right, that's going to be one of the first things I do when I get out of hospital. And it was. I started living independently in June or July of 2003. And by December, I'd made plans to go over to England with a new friend that I'd just made at the time, and flew to London, hired a car, drove up to Warrington.
Mate, you're making me one up. That's lovely.
Turned up on his doorstep.
Yeah. Fantastic. This has been such a gorgeous conversation. I can't thank you enough for leaning into the spirit of what I'm trying to do on Five My Life.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I think the listeners, that just you talking about redefining, I'm going to listen back to this, redefining a problem and things don't have to be done in the same way. I think there's really, apart from just being fascinating, get to know you better, right? It's just been really useful, interesting lessons to learn. And good luck with your cooking show. You're going to be the new Ramsay. You have to swear.
No,
a lot.
I'm not.
You're going to have to swear. That's what.
Well, it's not going to be based around cooking. It's going to be based around ideas.
People. Yeah. Exactly. There is a sixth choice on Five of My Life.
Okay.
And that is, who would you like to hear take the challenge next, and why?
Who would I like to hear? Are we talking about anywhere in the world, or is it like Australia, like recommending somebody?
They have
to
be alive. They can't be dead.
Yeah.
And I will follow them up. I follow everyone up.
Okay. There's a guy called, actually, no, you know what? I'm going to give you the second best.
The Batner person.
I'm going to give you the Batner.
I won't tell him or her that you were Tom's second choice.
Yeah, no, I won't give you the Batner. I think you should get on a guy called Bill Edgar.
Bill Edgar, okay.
Right. He is otherwise known as the Coffin Confessor.
The Coffin Confessor. I'm liking this already. Tell me about him.
And what Bill does is his job, he gets hired by people who are dying to turn up to their funerals and speak on behalf of the dead person. Often that entails telling a lot of the people that are there to fuck off.
Nice.
Because he didn't like them anyway, or they weren't there for him.
Right.
But he also does other things now. So like almost like a private detective in a way, where he'll go and sweep a house. So if you're dying and you can't go and get all the sex toys and porno DVDs out of your DVDs.
The magazines are in the drawer.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. He'll go and do that. He will leave items with dead people in their coffins if they want something. A lot of people want to keep their phones with them.
Is he a Yank or a...
No, he's Aussie.
Aussie?
Lives,
right.
Yeah, he lives up in Queensland.
Wow. Bill Edgar.
Bill Edgar, yeah. I reckon he'd be an interesting interview.
What a great recommendation. Tom, thank you for coming on Five My Life.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the show, and thank you for all your messages with guest suggestions and feedback on the episodes. The Five of My Life audience really is a lovely, engaged community. Please do keep the messages coming in. The best way is through my website. And if you have a friend who you feel might enjoy a particular guest, please do forward the episode on. I do the show on my own, so without a marketing budget, word of mouth really is the only way of people discovering the show.